All right, we're going to get started. Today is the October 17th, 2019 Planning Commission work session. I'm Jenna Kay with Community Planning. And this is the second time I'm before you now to talk about our Shoreline Master Program periodic review. Early September, I think you were here. Yeah, it was a while ago.
You mean you didn't do your homework? What in the world? We're all prepared. What's going on?
So that first meeting really was about letting you know this project was happening, and that today's purpose is to provide a bit more background on Shoreline Master Programs generally. Provide some program data on what's been happening in terms of development along shorelines since we last did our major update, or since we did our last major update, and then talk about where we are in the process, what's next, things like that. Because the next time I'll be in front of you, we'll have actual, you know, draft possible changes for you to review. So this is really to get you feeling oriented and and to ask your questions on making sure you feel like you have a good grasp of what this program is, the kinds of things that are in it, things like that. So, just as a refresher, this project is mandated by the State Shoreline Management Act, which is RCW 90.58, and we are required to review our Shoreline Master Program every 8 years and revise it if necessary. So this project really is about making sure our program is current, that we are addressing any new state laws that have come about in recent years, or if something's changed in the county that we need to address, that we do that. But this is not a major overhaul of the program like was completed in 2012. So the scope of the project is up on the screen. This is the Department of Ecology is the one who has outlined what we need to do. And like I said, it's really just doing a thorough review and seeing what changes seem necessary. And our goal is to be done with this by next summer.
Besides the Department of Ecology, do you have other administrations that oversee this too?
Yeah, so Department of Ecology is the main, the state agency that oversees this program, and so they're the ones who write any. Once legislation gets passed, they're the one who write the rules that we follow on designing our program and making changes and things like that. Right. So other agencies may be involved in having an opinion on things or in coordinating with Ecology on how certain rules are written, but Ecology is our go-to department. Okay, so just a bit more background about Shoreline Master Programs. Back in September, I introduced the intent of the Shoreline Management Act, which really is about preventing the inherent harm in an uncoordinated and piecemeal development of the state shorelines. And the Shoreline Management Act has three main policy goals, and those are up on the screen. So fostering reasonable and appropriate uses, making sure that the development you're allowing in shorelines makes sense, and there's a preference for water-dependent uses because those uses can't happen anywhere else. So water-dependent uses like maybe some port infrastructure or marina, something like aquaculture. They're dependent on water in order to for you to be able to do them. The second policy goal is to protect natural resources and the environment. And the third is to promote public access. And so that means both visual access, so people can enjoy scenic shoreline views. It means access to be able to get to the water through a shoreline area. And then also to be able to enjoy shorelines, such as a park along a water body or something like that. So digging in a little bit deeper in terms of what this program, like what's actually being regulated, One of the key things is that shoreline master programs, they regulate development in shorelines. So a key question then is, well, what exactly is considered development? And so what do the regulations apply to? So the Shoreline Management Act has its own definition of what that means, which matches what's in our code. And it is a very broad definition and includes a lot of things. So everything from new or expanded structures, so houses, sheds, decks. The structures can be in the water, too, so docks, buoys, boat ramps get covered by this definition. Alteration of land, so clearing vegetation, grading, dredging, filling, those kinds of things fall under the definition. And it even applies to things like restoration and trail construction a lot of the time as well. So it is a very broad definition, and I think that's one of the key things to understand. Some of those images are a little hard to see, but the idea there was to show a range of the kinds of development that might fall under a shoreline program, from industrial to residential to some very natural-looking areas that have very little development in them. All right, so that's one sort of key concept of the Shoreline Master Program. Another sort of key component of how the program is set up has to do with shoreline designations. So when I first introduced this project, I talked a little bit about, you know, there's over 300 miles of shoreline in the unincorporated part of Clark County. And and I talked a little bit about what is needed for a water body to get pulled into the program and how do you define, you know, the boundary of where shoreline jurisdiction is. But I want to talk a little bit more about these shoreline designations. And I'm going to actually open one of our interactive maps. So let's see if this works. Okay. So what I'm pulling up right now is, it's called a story map. We're using it as a test for this project. So anytime we have open houses, we are also having an online version of an open house available. So this is what that software looks like. And one of the nice things about it is it lets us show visual information as well as narrative written information. And we can also pull in some of our maps as well. So for instance, we have a copy of our shoreline map that'll load eventually. This isn't the best screen to look at it. But if you're curious, you can zoom in on areas of interest. You can also read brief descriptions on the different designations. We also have our shoreline map on Maps Online as well. So both of those are options if you want to look more closely, because it can be a little difficult to just look at all shorelines at once for the entire county. I'll use this map for now. So there are seven designations, and I just want to talk through each of them to provide so you get the overall idea of what the purpose of each of them is. So there is the blue on the map, which looks like water, is the aquatic designation, and this applies to areas that are waterward of the ordinary high watermark. So basically, most of this is water, and maybe areas that are sometimes underwater, sometimes not. And the purpose of this designation is for those uses that can only happen in water or right on the water's edge. So things like aquaculture or docks or boat launches are the types of uses that are allowed in an aquatic designation. The green is the natural designation. So you can see that there's by La Center, the La Center Bottoms area has that designation. We've also got some areas around the refuge area as well that are green. And this natural area designation is really for those areas that have had very little development on them. And one of the main purposes is to help protect those areas from further development. And the types of uses that are allowed in a natural designation are things like restoration, but also some types of stabilization. If it's a bioengineered stabilization project, that can be allowed. But there's very little there are very few uses and types of development that are allowed in these natural designated areas. So next, the brown color is urban conservancy. So we can see that there's a large section here along Salmon Creek. I think parts of Burnt Bridge Creek are also have this designation. So we'll zoom in there. So urban conservancy, the purpose of this designation is both about protecting and restoring the ecosystem along the shoreline. And but this is happening in urban and more developed environments, and it also allows other compatible uses. So some of those examples, you know, you can have some single-family residential, but you also can have things like trails as well. So there's a few more types of uses that are allowed in this designation. The orange color is medium intensity. So you can see some of that here also along Salmon Creek. Burnt Bridge Creek, I think, also has a good stretch of orange. And this designation is very focused on residential development, so and other sort of supporting uses that are compatible with that. So some commercial, some institutional, and actually I think some multifamily can also be built in medium intensity designations. And then there's the high intensity designation, which I don't believe we have any in the unincorporated area. I think it's all within city limits. But that's, you'll see it often where wherever we have a port within the county. Those are examples, like right here by Vancouver Lake, Port of Vancouver area. You see a fair amount of red. And these areas are showing up on places where there already is typically some sort of industrial or heavy commercial types of development. And they were on areas that were fairly degraded to begin with when they had that designation given to them. But this is the only designation where industrial uses are allowed. And then the other two designations are, we have rural conservancy residential, which is the yellow color, which is a little hard to see, but there's a lot of that in the county. And it is very rural in nature, and some low-impact recreational-type uses and low-density residential are allowed in that designation, but it has a very rural feel because it's showing up in our rural parts of the county. And then the purple is the Rural Conservancy Resource designation, and again, very rural feel. It's about both protecting our natural resources and the environment and also allowing natural resource type uses. So agriculture, forestry, things like that tend to be the main uses that are allowed in that designation. So one of the reasons I just wanted to give you the high level picture of these different designations is because they're kind of one of the key components. If you look at the regulations around shoreline management, there's a big use table that shows up in our code, and it's sorted by, you know, what uses are allowed in which designation. So that's really one of the key components that shows sort of how the regulations are getting at managing development in shorelines throughout the county. Okay. So I'm going to switch gears now. Okay. So I'm going to talk now about what's been going on. Like, what types of development have we been seeing in the past couple of years to just provide sort of additional lens of, you know, what's happening in our shorelines. And I already talked about this tool, but the data I'm going to show is available and sometimes easier to see in this online open house tool. Okay, so didn't used to collect much data on our shoreline program, but it's something we started to do after our 2012 update. And one thing we learned was that our county systems weren't set up that well to actually track key metrics about shoreline development, so we've been working on improving that. I'll just emphasize that some of the numbers and charts I'm going to show are not necessarily exact, because we did have to make some estimates off of old staff reports and things like that to get the data we were looking for. And then I guess the other kind of disclaimer about the data I'm going to show is that it is only going to be for a six-year period. So starting September 2012, when the new revised program went into effect, through 2018, because that's when we last pulled the data out of our system. So it's going to show about 6 years of information. And, you know, so any shoreline activity before or after that is not going to be reflected in what I'm going to show you. So it's more, we'll just give you an idea of what's been happening fairly recently since we revamped the program. The first thing is there were 173 shoreline projects approved in that time period. And when I say a project was approved, it either got some sort of shoreline permit or received a letter of exemption for that project. So it was reviewed by the county and, you know, it was authorized to move forward as a project. On this map, and there's a interactive, let me actually go back.
Is it about 23 projects a year?
Okay, I'm going to open this again just to show the interactive version of this.
About 23.
There's an interactive version in here, so I'm just going to show you kind of what's in here, but you can look more closely. So the highlighted parcels on this map are showing the parcels where projects were approved to take place. And the colors represent the different types of permits. So the red, for instance, are shoreline exemptions. And let's see, purple is a substantial development permit, green is a variance, and so forth. And you can zoom in on this version of the map, and you can click on a parcel and get a brief description of what it is and a little bit about the impacts. So in this case, this had to do with a renovation of the Lewis River campground, and we've got a few metrics under there on if there were any impacts, you know, the area of that, if there was any mitigation. This is not the best example because there are none of those. And we're also tracking if it was a restoration project or involved removing a fish barrier. So you can explore if you kind of just want a better feel of what types of projects have been going along. So this is another one. It was related to a single-family residence. So you can get the idea of the types of projects that have come before the county. Okay, let's go back here. The other thing after we mapped where the projects took place is I was a little bit curious on concentration of where people are developing in shoreline. While I saw some larger areas near La Center and north of Vancouver Lake, I kind of see a smattering of specks, you know, throughout the county. So I was like, okay, there's projects happening throughout. But wanted to look a little bit more closely at that to see if there was any certain areas we should pay more attention to or just be aware of. So we looked at number of projects by water resource inventory area. If you're not familiar with those, the county has two. Essentially, the northern part of the county is the Lewis water resource inventory area. The southern half is the Salmon Washougal. When we looked at where projects were falling, almost 50% was in each, so fairly evenly split. And then we also looked at where projects happening by water body. This is very hard to see on the screen, but most projects were in Salmon Creek, that's that top bar, followed by the North Fork Lewis and the East Fork Lewis River. And again, that should be easier to see on your iPad. And I think projects, we saw them on more than 25 different water bodies throughout the county. We also wanted to look at some of the impacts and mitigation. So roughly 41 acres of impacts to wetland and habitat conservation area were part of the applications that got approved, as well as 9 acres of new impervious surface being added in shoreline. And those impacts were mitigated by about 143 acres of mitigation. And so one of the reasons we wanted to look at this is because there is a concept called no net loss that is part of the Shoreline Management Act. So what that means is anytime anyone proposes a project in shoreline, they need to demonstrate that it's going to meet no net loss of ecological function after they do that project. So the ecosystem functions need to be just as good as they were before you did your project, you know, once the project is complete. And so if our regulations are written, you know, with no net loss in mind, and if applicants have to show this, we would hope to see that the mitigation is greater than the impacts. And the amount of mitigation, you know, it can range from a 1-to-1 ratio to a 4-to-1 ratio, depending on what you're impacting. So there's quite a range in the amount of mitigation that might be required for a project.
So on average, it looks like you're about 3-to-1 here.
Yes, that's what this is looking like based on the projects that came through. But it could vary, you know, depending on the projects that are getting proposed. You could expect that could be a different ratio in the future, depending on the projects. And then the other thing to keep in mind is if we change anything in our shoreline regulations as part of this project, we also need to show that it meets the no net loss standard. Like, that's one of our required criteria that you all will have to consider for any proposed changes. So just a key concept that we want to keep in mind. But this was a key check for us on how are we doing. So seems like we are consistent with the standard, at least at this high level look.
So does mitigation have to happen on the same site where the impact was, or can it be done somewhere else to kind of make up for the impact?
Yeah. So it's typically on the same site, but not always. And then, Brent, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe we try to get it within the same reach. Sometimes you can't physically fit it on the site, or the type of mitigation you just can't do there. It does need to be happening somewhere nearby. And I believe it's the same reach. Is that right, Brent? So we also looked at impacts and mitigation by water body. We can actually go down to the reach level as well. This is very hard to see. So the purple, so the left side of the bar graph is impacts. The blue is mitigation. So I've got East Fork Lewis here with the most impacts, followed by Curtin Creek after that. And this is just showing the 10 water bodies that had the most impacts from projects. I was a bit curious why these on the left, you know, were substantially experienced a lot more impacts than some of the other water bodies. So I was looking into the projects that were approved for those rivers and creeks. So for the East Fork Lewis River, all those impacts are from 2 restoration projects, actually. So that was kind of interesting. And then the Curtin Creek impacts are from basically 1 road improvement project that was in that shoreline area. So sort of as you dig, you get another layer of context. Just because they're impacts doesn't mean it's, you know, all impervious surface being added in the shoreline. So it's good to, I think, understand what's been going on. Okay. Speaking of restoration projects, of the 173 projects approved, 8 of them were restoration projects. And this chart is showing, you know, by water body how many acres of restoration are expected once those restoration projects are complete. You can see a lot of that is along the East Fork Lewis River, followed by the Columbia River and Lake River. This acreage is in addition to those mitigation numbers I showed previously. So we split out, you know, what's mitigating for impacts and then what's additional restoration. There is an associated restoration plan that goes along with the shoreline program. And so this was an important thing for us to look at as well. And then this is the last chart I'm going to show you. We also were curious about, you know, what kinds of permits are we handing out? What are the types of projects that we are seeing? And that light purple is for shoreline exemptions. So we definitely get the majority of our projects meet one of the exemptions that's written into the regulations. So if you're doing a project that is exempt, what that means is there's about, I don't know, it's like 15, I think it's about 15 things on our list of exemptions in our code, and it ranges from things like emergency construction projects to restoration projects to certain types of single-family home projects, if they meet certain criteria, are considered exempt. So it actually includes a wide range of things. But if someone submits an application and demonstrates that they meet one of the exemptions and are otherwise consistent with the Shoreline Master Program, then they get a letter of exemption and don't need to get an actual permit to do their project. So they get a letter from the county saying, you're good to go. Okay, so just where are we at in the process? That's all that's left. So we've talked to DEEB, the Parks Advisory Board. The League of Women Voters invited us to one of their meetings to talk about the project. And we had an open house in late September. And these conversations so far have been, again, letting people know about the project. So if they want to participate, they know, you know, the timeline and how to do that. And we are also collecting initial feedback in terms of, do you have any, you know, concerns about our shorelines in the county that we should know about and be keeping in mind as we go through this review process? So I've got some of the topics that we've heard so far in these conversations listed on the right side of the screen. There seems to be lots of interest in, you know, public access to shorelines, trails where you can see water, things like that, with the acknowledgement that that's actually very hard to do because of all of the regulations for our critical areas and shoreline. There's some concern about people who disregard our regulations and do shoreline development anyway and are in violation of our code. So I've heard a number of stories about that. Also, a recommendation to the county could do better at education and outreach around our shoreline program and how to do better with shoreline protection. I heard some questions about why aren't we doing an extensive amount of ecological data analysis on our shorelines like we did back with our big update in 2012, which, if you're curious on the answer to that, has to do with sort of the scope of this project as established by ecology, right? So they are basically giving us guidelines, you know, on what we need to do and are giving us grant funding to do that, and that analysis is not part of it, but it was a big part at that last big update. So that's the primary reason why that's not happening. And then also got some questions about how climate change fits into this review and this program, and nothing, you know, no specific feedback, but I was able to talk about how there are some aspects of this program that seem well aligned with climate change in terms of if our flood maps change, you know, if FEMA gives us a new map, we need to reflect it, you know, so if things like that change, they will get incorporated into the program. But again, nothing specific yet on that. And so next is us having draft recommendations of things to change or that we could change for the program. We are hoping to share those with the public in mid-November, where we'll do a series of open houses to get feedback on those possible changes. And then I will be back before you to share what we're thinking and get your initial feedback and questions on those specific possible changes. So, we're in that middle rectangle right now, and then once we have a solid draft, we'll move into the more formal stuff starting next year. So that's all I have. I'm glad to answer any questions. We also have Brent, who's our shoreline administrator, in the room, so if you have any other questions about what he sees when he's on site, he's happy to answer.
So that's it? That's all you got? Oh.
This is the primer for when she comes out.
Right.
Yeah.
So based on your discussion about ecological data and analysis, does that mean we're not monitoring the health of these waterways?
Through this program, so not exactly, but sort of. So that's not a helpful answer. So when we are monitoring, when we get project proposals, we can track the developments themselves, right, and the impacts we expect to have. But that's not telling you about what that's doing to the water quality, right, or things like that.
Right.
So that data is being collected through other, you know, other initiatives, right, in the county that are focused on water quality. But when we did the update in 2012, a whole lot of different data sets were looked at to assess stream health of every reach, you know, of these, mm-hmm. of the water that's in the shoreline program. So it's that analysis and sort of compilation of all those data sets that isn't really in the scope of this project. So there is some data out there, but I guess the analysis of pulling it all together and looking, you know, at each reach in the shoreline program isn't really in the scope of this project.
So how do we know what we're doing here is working?
That's a good question. and I don't know, Brent, if you want to chime in on that.
Brent Davis, the Shoreline Administrator. So I oversee all of the permit reviews and the implementation of the master program at project level. So to answer your question, in I guess the most straightforward way, we don't. It's no different than our critical areas ordinance. I would say, given the data with regard to how much activity we're permitting in the shoreline area, that to look at the effectiveness of these regulations on those bigger picture items like water quality, ecological health of our riparian corridors, we just don't have enough data to actually have a statistically significant sample to be able to say whether those regulations or lack of effective regulation in that arena is a, you know, cause and effect to anything that might be going on in at a watershed scale. That's just going to take a lot more time, and there's a lot of other factors involved because, you know, all the critical areas outside of the shoreline area, the management of those affects what we see in the shoreline streams, and, you know, all the development at the watershed scale, same thing. So at this point, we're not really doing anything different than what our water quality program is doing for watershed planning and for water quality monitoring. And, you know, ecology is doing some monitoring for their monitoring program under the Federal Clean Water Act. And that's where we're at.
So we are monitoring water quality in another department within the county? Who's doing the water quality?
Yeah, the Clean Water Program has a water quality monitoring program. They have two or three staff that spend the bulk of their time maintaining equipment, collecting samples, sending things to the labs for analysis and collating the results. And that's all being driven by our MPDS permit.
Okay. So in situations where we have, like, several projects, say, on the East Fork of the Lewis or Curtin Creek, if we're monitoring those, we would have before and after data of some sort.
We have the baseline that was established with the 2012 update. And that was the purpose of that major analysis effort, was to establish a baseline. We have some data that's site-specific for that project that was collected at the time of application or during the review of the application in terms of existing functions and values on the site. And then we have the data as to what was permitted. One thing we aren't doing right now is actually doing follow-up with as-built verification of what actually is getting built compared to what was permitted, partially because it's, you know, it's an added expense and it would either need to be passed on to the property owner, the applicant, or, you know, the county would have to find a way to pay for it. So the only time we find out something may be going on differently with a permit is if we get a complaint from a neighbor that something doesn't appear to be right. But we also know in some cases people aren't actually building everything that they get permitted. So I'm not going to suggest that there's a balance. It's probably swayed more towards people doing a little more than what they proposed. But, you know, we don't have that data, and we don't have a program in place at this point to collect that data. And quite frankly, when we've been asking Ecology for advice on how to implement our monitoring plan, because that was new in the 2012 update in the Shoreline Master Program, they're providing very little guidance. They basically approved our monitoring plan, and when we asked questions about, well, how do we do this, you know, how should we present this information, what kind of specific metrics should we be using, they're like, that's up to you. And there doesn't seem to be a push from them at this point to really take the next step and heavily rely on that data in this update process. I think they're still kind of struggling with how to do that because a lot of other jurisdictions aren't even collecting the data that we're collecting.
Hey.
Even though it might be in their master program to do so. So
we don't have a great answer for you, but that's kind of where we are at.
Yeah, and, you know, it's monitoring on all this stuff, whether it's shorelines or critical areas, is the piece that always is kind of, you know, mentioned at the policy level, but, you know, it is very slowly moving into implementation over time. I mean, in the time scale of decades at this point. Just because it's very resource intensive, and you know, no one's figured out a good way to fund it, because it does take a lot of work.
Maybe technology will catch up, and we'll be able to take monitors and put it in all of the waterways, and then be able to have all that data collected in where people don't have to go out and physically check. We'll know temperatures, we'll know bacteria, we'll know everything.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that technology is available, but it's also expensive to operate and maintain.
That's just that one little hurdle.
Yeah.
That's just one little hurdle. We just, if there's a will, there's a way. Mm-hmm. So start with one. Buy one every year, and in 100 years, wow.
Well, the primary reason I'm asking the question is we're spending time and effort to ensure no net loss. But what's the contribution to maintaining no net loss? And right now, it doesn't sound like we know.
Well, the question is, no net loss of what?
Well, yeah, and I mean, the regulation says no net loss of ecological function.
Right.
And all we can say is that we're doing a lot more mitigation than we're allowing impact. But whether that mitigation is effective and accomplishing the goals that we expect it to is... is another question. And one of the reasons that ratio is skewed is because we know that there are failures, and the risk is built into the calculation of those ratios.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Yeah. Any other questions?
So March, February?
In terms of hearing? Uh-huh. Yeah, I think... My best guess right now is that this would be going to a Planning Commission hearing in March. I think that's our best estimate of that, so, right now. But we'll keep you posted. I think we're scheduled in early December to come back with the draft list of changes. If we need more time, we'll push it out. So, all right.
Cool.
Well, thank you all.
Thank you. It was a lot of hard work.